Good morning and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. It's April 7, 2021, and we're ready for our first argument. We'll follow the usual rules. You'll each have 15 minutes and 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose to use it. And when you begin your arguments, please state your name for the record because this is being recorded and will be put on our website within a day. And with that, Mr. Benson, are you ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor, thank you. And may it please the court and counsel, Scott Benson from the firm of Briel and Benson, on behalf of the appellants, One Love Housing and Nate Pearson. Your Honors, this is a discrimination case. The Federal Fair Housing Act and the Americans with Disability Act prohibit discrimination against disabled people, including alcoholics and addicts. The FHA and the ADA, through the Supremacy Clause, as well as state law, prohibit this type of discrimination. So this isn't simply a land use case where two people had a land dispute and the city stepped in. Nonetheless, the city of Cambridge wants deference as to its decision where it prejudged One Love's request for reasonable accommodation before it was even made. The Federal Fair Housing Act amendments of 1988 and its legislative history shows a congressional intent that the courts should no longer defer to city zoning codes that discriminate against the disabled. That had happened for far too long. This is also an important case, Your Honors. The challenges that addicts and alcoholics face in our society are great, and One Love Sober Home offers addicts and alcoholics the opportunity of recovery through a therapeutic environment that is proven to be effective for them in their continuum of care to get on their feet and recover. Just a little road.
Mr. Benson, yes. A roadmap would be helpful because when I looked at the chronology from both sides, I was a little confused by what was submitted when and what was considered before the decision was made. And so your client submitted a lot of like the floor plan and the plan for the house, I think on April 16th, is that right?
No, that's not right, Your Honor.
And I took a look at the papers that were submitted then. So if you could help me understand the chronology from your point of view.
Thank you, Your Honor. And the facts are important in this case. As we noted, the summary judgment standard is a high one in Minnesota. And so the facts are important here. But here, all of the facts basically support our view as to the reasonable accommodation being denied. In March of 2018, One Love's counsel, Mr. Merritt, approached the city, Ms. Westover, and said, "What's your process for a reasonable accommodation? Because we see right now that your city ordinance allows for four unrelated people. What would your accommodation be for a sober home for more than four people?" But Mr. Merritt at that point in time didn't submit anything as to the floor plan, et cetera. At some point he submitted, here's what we submit typically for the city of Minneapolis and other cities, but he didn't make a reasonable accommodation request of the city at that point in time. Before he did so, on April 16th, 2018, Ms. Westover testified that she decided after consulting with the city attorney and another city staff member, Ms. Levitsky, that any sober home in Cambridge's R1 district would be treated as a residential facility and allowed six residents. And again, this was weeks before One Love submitted its request for reasonable accommodation that included maps and a plant, parking plan, et cetera. That didn't happen
until— So help me understand, what day do you say that One Love submitted its request for reasonable accommodation?
That occurred on May 1, Your Honor, 2018.
And so what happened on May 16th?
On May 1st and on May 16th, first of all, on May 1st, Ms. Westover said, no, we deny this request. And on May 16th, the city attorney sent an letter to One Love Housing's attorney saying, we aren't going to further entertain your request for a reasonable accommodation. And it's important to note, Your Honor, that Ms. Westover testified that it wouldn't have mattered what One Love said in its request for reasonable accommodation. She wouldn't have changed her mind that they could only allow six in a R1 residential district in the city of Cambridge. So Ms. Westover essentially prejudged One Love's request for reasonable accommodation.
Mr. Benson, if I can jump in on that point. It's a point you make in the brief, and I'd like you to connect it a little bit for me. It seems like in your brief, you're arguing that failure to consider the facts of this case, to go on a case-by-case basis, that failure of the city itself is a violation of the FHA. On the other hand, you could be arguing that the reason that you make a big deal out of the city's failure to go case-by-case or to make a fact-based determination here is because it goes to the other claims, the reasonable accommodation claim, specifically whether there's an undue burden, that it goes to whether there's a legitimate non-discriminatory reason, or whether it's a pretext for something else. So I can see how it would fit in under the undue burden analysis, and I can see how it would fit in under a disparate treatment analysis. But I'm not sure I am following if that's the argument you're making, or if instead you're arguing that was a failure or a violation of the FHA itself, separate and apart from undue burden.
Yeah, Your Honor, there's three ways that a city could fail and has done so in this case under the Fair Housing Act. One is a failure to make a reasonable accommodation. And a reasonable accommodation, the circumstances in which you judge that are, did the city make a fact-specific determination? And the city in this case has claimed
Let me jump in. Yeah. Because I understand how in the reasonable accommodation, the district court at the summary judgment stage is looking at the evidence and deciding if there's a question of fact or reasonable inferences that can be made to lead to a question of fact regarding the reasonableness or the necessity of the requested accommodation. I'm not so clear that the law requires the district court to review whether the decision maker, the city, considered the reasonableness of the accommodation. Do you see the distinction? One is considering the reasonableness, one is considering someone else's consideration of reasonableness or necessity. And it's that piece of it that I'm not sure, so maybe you can help clarify whether there is a separate violation of the FHA that requires the district court to consider whether the decision maker considered the reasonableness of the accommodation, or if the inquiry is instead simply, is the accommodation request a reasonable one? Is it necessary? And you follow the reasonable accommodation standards.
Your Honor, the case of the Court of Appeals case of Citizens for a Balanced City versus the Plymouth Congregational Church sets this out pretty clearly. That and they cite the Oconomowoc case from the Seventh Circuit and basically say, yes, there needs to be by the city a fact-specific case-by-case determination. Also, you can look to the Esslings Homes case, Your Honor, that's cited in our material. Both those cases put that onus on the city to make a fact-specific.
And I guess my question is, are those cases, is the authority requiring us to look at the fact-specific consideration the city made as part of undue burden or as part of an LNDR, legitimate non-discriminatory reason? Or is there some other provision of the FHA that requires fact-based decision-making and that's a separate violation?
Yes, it's part of the reasonable accommodation determination that there has to be a fact-specific case-by-case review of whether or not there was a reasonable accommodation offered by the city. And Your Honor, so what are you reviewing? Well, you're reviewing, is it reasonable and is it necessary? And then you look to see the balancing part of that test is there an undue burden on the city administrative or financial burden? And in this case, Your Honor, we meet each of those standards. First of all, the request is reasonable. How do you know if the request is reasonable? Well, the case law basically says, is it reasonable on its face in the ordinary course or in the run of cases? We have that here. You've seen the many cases that Oxford House has brought that has determined that in these sober home cases, it is reasonable to allow more than the number of unrelated people that the zoning code has. So in the ordinary run of cases, you see this is a normal case. There is no heightened standard set by the Hindenburg case for Minnesota to determine reasonableness. That case decided that they didn't even need to reach that decision. That Hindenburg versus Big Stone HRA case said they would assume that plaintiffs had acted reasonably. Next, we have whether or not the request is necessary. And in this case, Your Honor, that was primarily what the district court focused on, was whether or not the request was necessary. And here again, we meet the standard of necessity.
Mr. Benson, when did you provide the testimony or affidavit of Chris Erdington to the city?
At the time that the decision was made, Your Honor?
No, when did you provide that?
Your Honor, that was, yes, that was part of the litigation.
I know it was, but I'm curious about when you provided it to the city.
I believe the affidavit was provided as part of our reply in the summary judgment motions, Your Honor.
So it was not provided to the city so they could consider that when they were making their decision.
No, Your Honor, Mr. Edrington's report was provided in the regular course of this litigation as ordered by the court. But if you read the...
Do you know the date that it was provided?
I do not, other than it was part of the litigation. It was not provided as part of the consideration because, of course, Ms. Westover made her decision without any evidence being before her. So we couldn't have provided anything from Mr. Edrington or anybody. She made her decision before anything was submitted to the city. And Your Honor, if you look at the Esslings Homes case, that case is very clear that the court may consider and should consider, it's on page 977 of that decision, that the court can consider things beyond what was submitted to the city during the course of their determination as to whether or not there was a reasonable accommodation. That Esslings Homes case—
I'm sorry, you finished your thought. I didn't mean to interrupt.
No, Your Honor. I was just going to say that Esslings Homes case is very clear on that point.
I wanted to follow up with Judge Riley's question. So what we know, and I understand there's a bit of a question, the timing of the city's decision, although it's my understanding legal counsel's response was clearly after all the information that One Love provided. But I want to rise just a little bit higher level because you make the point in your briefing numerous times and believe the judge didn't focus on the fact this is a discrimination case. But aren't we, we're kind of at two competing overriding issues. One is that we generally give discretion. The law requires discretion to cities' reasonable ordinances and zoning, which here, of course, it's created long before One Love buys the house and makes this request for an accommodation. And then secondly, the question is whether in a big picture, discrimination by its decision of its zoning against one who's chemically dependent, the sober house residents. And what I'm having a little bit of a struggle with understanding here, number one, an accommodation was made. I don't think it's undisputed. The question, of course, is whether it's reasonable, but you a few moments ago made a reference to it's reasonable. So if they don't have the expert analysis, which I understand didn't actually have a number, but talked about familial, and they've approved other sober houses at six, was there any information, for instance, that was given to the city that there's either your client or other clients, multiple similar homes where there was more than six, perhaps the 14 or 15 that your client requested, along with some reasoning of why that's necessary, so that the city, then you could balance that, you could show the district court and then it would be in our record.
Yeah, yes, Your Honor, there is. In the reasonable accommodation request and Mr. Hoffner's letter to the city, Mr. Hoffner notes that the greatest problem for alcoholics and addicts is loneliness, and that this is required, having a full house and having the number of people that Mr. Hoffner and One Love was requesting is necessary so that addicts and alcoholics don't face their greatest problem, which was loneliness and not having people with whom they could share their sober journey. And so that was provided to the city and a citation to cases as well in which this had been shown.
That but how does provided- that, what I'm trying to get at those, so is one more lonely at 6 versus 14? That's the, what that expert, I assume, was the reasoning that was presented to the district court, but the city didn't have that. No. In other words, it allowed for an accommodation, so up to 6 people in this residential home, which already is above the 4 limit.
That's true. The city did not have that information from the expert at the time it made its decision. As I said, though, it didn't have anything in front of it at the time it made its decision. And Ms. Westover testified, no matter what the city, no matter what Wunlow would have told her, wouldn't have mattered. Your Honor, I'm happy to answer further questions. I see my time is up, though.
And you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose to use it. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Ms. Shui.
Good morning, Your Honors. This is Attorney Jessica Shui of Kennedy and Graven. I am representing the City of Cambridge in this matter. I want to give you an overarching view then and respond to some of the questions that Your Honors have already asked. First of all, in the reply brief, it was suggested that the city was effectively playing fast and loose with the cases that we've cited.
There we go. I didn't see the clock. Okay.
You able to hear me okay? Yes. Okay. it is important for this court to understand that, one, there's not a case directly on point. The closest case would be the Haven unpublished Court of Appeals case. Any one of the cases that the parties have cited to the court, including those relied upon by plaintiff, and let's use Essling, the District of Minnesota case, those cases acknowledge that FHA and ADA claims, when you're analyzing them, it is appropriate to look at case law developed in other contexts, particularly those contexts, including the employment context. Okay. So now I'm going to bring us back to one of Judge Bryan's questions. Is there a violation of the FHA effectively because the city simply considered this by the community developmental director making a decision without, you know, a subsequent, I'll call a city council process where there was a back and forth? No, it is not a violation of the FHA or the ADA. Reason why, similar to an employment situation, I can't cite you to a case on point, but I can cite you to the employment cases. We did that in our appellate brief, and it's appropriate to do that because that's what courts rely upon in part in making decisions, even in this land use context. Okay, so we look at those cases and they say, what information was before the employer at the time that it made its decision? That's what's fair and just to hold the employer to, not something that was developed later in litigation. And Your Honors have already picked up on the Erdington report. Judge Riley, unfortunately, I can't give you quite the date that it was submitted to the city. The Erdington report only came up in the context of litigation. It was properly disclosed within the time limits of discovery and the rules of discovery, and then used to support the summary judgment motion by Wunlow.
So, Michelle, essentially, it sounds like you're saying that there would never be any expert testimony in discrimination cases because that expert testimony is not, you know, you don't seek it out until after there's a lawsuit. So I'm having a little bit of hard time with the logic of what you're arguing, given the prevalence of types of testimony that doesn't exist until a legal case is brought regarding reasonableness, regarding necessity, or regarding disparate treatment, disparate impact.
Well, Your Honor, respectfully, I disagree because there is many, many cases and situations where that evidence comes into the employer, the school district, or the city at the time that the decision is being considered. And I'll cite the case of Super America versus City of Little Canada to this.
I guess the more important case for me is a case that says it's improper for the district court to consider expert testimony when that expert testimony was developed after the decision was made.
Right.
That's the case that it sounds like, that's the proposition it sounds like you're asking us to apply.
And I am.
Sure I see that case.
Yep. I cannot give you a case directly on point, and that's where we've used a blended of cases. And the One Love has cited this court to Essling and says, look, Essling talks about that. And it's true, Essling does. Essling, a District of Minnesota federal case, says, let's talk about this. We've got one Eighth Circuit decision here that says when we're reviewing an administrative agency's decision, it is limited to the record developed before the administrative agency. And then we've got a more recent decision that said, well, we're going to expand that here because there's an appearance of impropriety in the formulation of this record. And then it goes on to talk about some cases, right?
So Ms. Shui, I have a hard time understanding the city's logic with regard to B&Bs and especially senior homes that are allowed in R1.
Right. The important distinction there is those types of uses are statutorily regulated and licensed entities. So in fact, in the Hindenburg case, the Supreme Court talks about the fact that effectively the statutes there preempt the city's zoning ordinance in terms of whether you can limit to six. And it says, look, no, in the case of group home facilities, you can have more than six, is statutorily preempted. That's an important distinction for in this case in One Love's use. One Love's proposed use is not state licensed. The only regulation and enforcement comes in at the city level. Yep.
I wanted to make sure I understood the city code correctly. And it seems to me that there are multiple types of R1 zoned homes that
yes.
can have more than six, not just senior homes, rooming and boarding houses, which can have up to 10 residents in addition to members of the keeper's family, bed and breakfast, which can have up to occupants of up to five rooms plus owner's family, but also families. And so the distinction isn't just between the sober home request and other more regulated homes, because there's also a distinction being made between the sober homes request and a family request. And so I guess the real question for me is when you look at Ms. Westover's statements, her testimony, why don't those statements create a question of fact on the issue of whether the accommodation is reasonable when you have all of these other exceptions to the residence limit? What are the inferences that the district court should have drawn from Ms. Westover's testimony that are in favor of the non-moving party?
Your Honor, I still don't think there's a factual issue developed as a result of that or any inferences that the district court should have drawn and that it failed to have drawn. Again, Your Honor has it correct. There are multiple residential zones within the city of Cambridge. In each of those zones, there are single family dwellings. In each of those zones, a single family dwelling can be put to increased use as the zone develops. And I'll go from R1 to R4. An important part here, this specific proposed use could be in an R4 as a permitted right. And it's important to note, in the city of Cambridge, R4 zones are built for that type of use.
Right, but I was talking about R1. And if you look at the exceptions made to a resident limit for R1 zones, not R4, but for R1 zones, you can have family members that are up to 14 people in a single home. You can have 10 to 12 for boarding houses and senior homes and bed and breakfasts. So the distinction that's being made, that's the real question. Was the decision to allow exceptions to the resident limit, the decision not to allow an exception for the sober home that you allow for these other examples, these four, maybe even more examples in an R1, is that decision, that distinction, is that a reasonable one? And then you look at the testimony of Ms. Westover and you ask, what does the district court have to conclude or infer based on that testimony?
So as I was going to continue on, Your Honor, and so now we're back in the R1 zone. And again, when it comes to a boarding house, when it comes to a nursing home, some of these other uses that have been identified and to which One Love is comparing themselves, those are state licensed facilities. And it is an important distinction because then there's additional regulations placed on those homes. And there is Minnesota Supreme Court case law saying the city's zoning ordinance on any limitations on the number of residents are effectively preempted by these state statutes that allow for these types of special uses, boarding houses, the senior homes. The most analogous that Your Honor used was a family of 14 people. And One Love does focus on that. Could you have in this house a family of 14 people? The answer is yes. And this was our argument where we were pointed to Costley and said, this is an unreasonable use and it's inappropriate to look at this type of use as a family use because you still have that number of individual adults. All of them have the ability to have a driver's license, the ability to have a vehicle, the ability to come back and forth from the house, which they in fact do because they are expected to as part and parcel of recovery is to take care of themselves. You go do your own grocery shopping, you go get your own haircut, you go get these things. Those, and again, this goes to how is the district built and why we have R1 versus R2, R3, R4. A family use, when you have 14 people, is still transitional in nature. Those 14 people, presumably most of them are children, they age out of the house. They're not all licensed drivers. And there's still some type of authority in the house that sets the rules. They're not individual adults leading their own separate lives, engaged in recovery. And so the concept of family is different. And this is something, to the point of reasonableness, this is something recognized by case law that is, and including this United States Supreme Court cases to which we cited this court, that results in a fundamental change. Fundamental and substantial change to the zoning ordinance, the zoning districts, the zoning policy, the comprehensive plan that was established by the city long before. To the degree,
I'm sorry, if you want to finish your thought, I wanted to follow up actually what you're saying now, maybe in response to both Judge Bryan and your earlier statement. It sounds now you're focusing on the reasonableness of the zoning ordinance and it generally, as opposed to the aggrieved party, the appellants. My question is, you referenced earlier that we must, and the court properly focused on what the city had before it, but you notice Mr. Benson brought it up again today and we see it replete in the briefing that the city had its mind made up before even the information that was requested of the city and submitted. Can you help both in terms of the timeline Judge Riley asked about and just respond generally to that?
Yes, I can. So it is correct. Opposing counsel has correctly outlined that the initial conversation took place March 29th. And during that conversation, One Love says, is this going to be enough for you to make a decision? There's a response by the city 4/16/18, and this I'm citing to the land use record. This is page 268. We think we're going to treat it like a residential facility. We'll need more information, provides a list of questions to be answered. 4/24/18 is when there's a response, including an application completed using the Minneapolis form because the city said, go ahead and use the Minneapolis form, complete that out. Then the city responds May 1st, 2008. It is fair to say they effectively reaffirm that they're going to limit this to 6, but then the city provides at this point a specific reason. They specifically note that there's other areas in the city that would allow the type of use that they're requesting, that they're going to allow 6, not the 4. So it's a partial grant of the reasonable accommodation and denies more than 6 because it could have been in other areas is the primary reason that they cite in other zones, effectively reaffirming its zoning. Then on August 6, 2018, there was the enforcement letter that was issued and later a closed session. It is correct to say that as opposing counsel noted, that Baby and Hoffner submitted a letter contesting the city's decision, but the community developmental director, development director made this final decision May 1st, 2018. There was a subsequent challenge to that decision by Hoffner. But again, that final decision was made May 1st, 2018. And to wrap it up on the reasonableness of that, it's not only just, you know, the zoning concepts, but there are other single family dwellings available in the city where this use could have been provided. When you go from 4 to a proposed 13 people, this is a request that is over 100% deviation from the city's policies and expectations and how it's developed the zone for the entire general welfare. That's unreasonable as a matter of law. There's decisions in this jurisdiction on that. They are zoning decisions. And this is a case that it requires the court to meet zoning decisions with FHA decisions, but we're looking at over 100% deviation. With that, Your Honors, I see my time has expired. Unless you have any further questions, I respectfully request that the decision of the lower court be affirmed.
Judges Slater, Brian, any further questions? Thank you, Ms. Shui. Mr. Benson.
Your Honor, housing is different from employment. Employment is a privilege. Housing, even for addicts, is a necessity. And housing in a sober home is a necessity. So just Ms. Shui saying that this is just like an employment case, that's not true. And that's not what courts have decided. I urge the court to look at this Esslingsholm's case because the court couldn't be clearer that the Eighth Circuit has changed its position with regard to whether or not evidence can come in after, during the trial phase as to whether or not the request is reasonable and necessary. And it says it can. And it cites numerous other cases from other jurisdictions and FHA cases that say the courts can consider evidence that comes in after the administration has made its decision. Now, with regard to the issue of the Haven case, I didn't touch on that. The Haven case is not authority here. And that really is what the district court made its decision on. And that was simply wrong. The Haven case didn't deal with a sober home. It dealt with a residential treatment program. In the Haven case, there was no evidence that they needed additional people beyond 6 in order to lend to the effectiveness of that residential treatment center. Here you have testimony from Crystal Hill. You have testimony from the expert in this case. You have Mr. Hoffner's letter saying it is a necessity in this case to go beyond 7, or rather to go beyond 6 and to have 13 people. Plus, there's a financial necessity in this case for this home to exist at all. And that you are allowed to consider. And we cited the King case versus Jones County, Arkansas for that.
Benson, I know that you're relying on Essling, but it seems that the Torgerson versus Rochester case, which is a 2011 Eighth Circuit case, makes it questionable whether Essling is still good law. Could you address the Torgerson case?
Your Honor, that case does not say, particularly in a case, the Torgerson case does not say, particularly in a case like here, where the testimony was that the city decided before there was any evidence before it. That case does not prohibit consideration of an expert opinion put in during the court proceedings. There is not a prohibition in the Eighth Circuit that would change Essling's decision of that nature. So as was pointed out by the court, how else would you ever have expert testimony come in? Because that's not typically the type of thing you would submit to the city. You would submit what basically Mr. Hoffner did, say, here's the reason this is necessary. And other courts have determined it's necessary to have more than 6, to have 10, 11, 12, 13. It's necessary because that is part of how these people are going to recover. That is part of how you create a therapeutic environment. He explained that in his letter of May 1st. And the city had that before it when Ms. Shui claims they actually made their decision. But you know from the testimony from Ms. Westover that she actually made her decision on April 16th before she saw any of this.
Mr. Benson, if I could ask you to address the sort of appealability argument regarding the expert's statements and whether or not a notice of related appeal was required before the city could challenge the court's decision to essentially allow that or admit it into the record.
Yes, Your Honor. And to be quick on that, as you know, you must file a notice of related appeal in order to challenge decisions of the lower court. And so both on accepting the testimony of Mr. Etherington, which the lower court apparently did, and also accepting that there was standing for One Love, both of those decisions by the lower court weren't challenged by the city of Cambridge. They didn't file a notice of related appeal, and they had to do so in order to have that be before this court. And clearly, even if you do consider it, Mr. Etherington is qualified under the Minnesota rules as to what constitutes expert opinion. He has been an operator of sober homes. He has seen how sober homes operate. He has seen how they can create a therapeutic environment that benefits the people, and he sees why that's necessary. And clearly, this is the same type of thing in the necessity standpoint. And it's not a but-for test, the necessity test. It's a test to see if it will ameliorate their condition. And clearly, having more people in the home does so. On that basis, Your Honors, we would ask that the court remand this to the lower court with direction to entry summary judgment in One Love's favor and determine attorney's fees.
Thank you. The case is submitted. It was thoroughly briefed, should we say, and well argued, and we'll have our decision out within the statutory time frame. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honors.